It generally is. In 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to Ryan Explains the Universe!
That's my line. What the hell? Sorry, welcome to Ryan Reviews the Universe. My name is Ryan Masoncup. Bringing you the best takes for the best times for you, the best people. I'm here with my good friend Chelsea. Chelsea, I guess, is our bar/philosophy correspondent. And we're here to talk mainly about philosophy, but we'll talk cocktails and bartending maybe a little bit at the end. Chelsea, you're going to be you're going to get your PhD over at University of Oregon pretty soon. And we just wanted to talk, I don't know.
PhD, and the PhD stands for pretty huge dumbass.
is that what it stands
just
for?
Kidding, no.
Did a brief, like, I know maybe more than, I know like a tiny bit about philosophy, not that much at all. Did a little Google Wikipedia dive last night.
Mm-hmm.
So I know epistemology, logics, ethics, metaphysics, all that jazz. Of the four, which do you kind of specialize in per se?
I would say, so ethics can also fall under the general category of value theory. And then ethics is sort of, obviously the more well-known, like what we value is right or wrong.
Okay.
But value theory can also include aesthetics, which is more of like a value of what is beautiful, art, things like that. I feel like aesthetics is probably my area where I'm most interested in. I know the most out of all of those about ethics.
Okay.
Like, I feel the most confident talking about like different ethical theories. I've taken a class on epistemology and metaphysics both recently. Metaphysics probably a little bit more personally interesting, mostly just because it's frustrating.
And ethics as it applies to philosophy is stuff like, what does it mean to be moral, right? And then, like, if people have heard of, say, like, the trolley problem, like, mm-hmm. that's what they're talking about there, right?
Yeah, that's, like, an applied case where we can kind of, like, test our ethical theories.
Okay.
So there's generally 3 for sure big ones in ethics. I would argue 4 big ethical theories, of like views of how you like judge whether or not something is a good or bad action.
And
right?
What would those be?
So you have like the Aristotelian virtue ethics.
Okay.
Which is kind of all about like finding that golden middle. He refers to it as like the mean between a virtue and a vice. So,
but wouldn't you always want to be virtuous in theory, or is it like, because that's unattainable, like that's why you're trying to get that middle ground there? Or
yes, but well, in theory, so like one common example that is used is like, think about courageous, like you want to be a courageous person, you want to be like, but sometimes you can be too courageous to the point where you're foolhardy and you make stupid mistakes, like in battle.
Oh, okay.
You might end up hurting yourself or someone else because you're trying too hard to like be that like hero figure.
Yeah.
Or on the opposite spectrum, you have like, you know, the people who are too scared to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to try to find that like, and there's all like, so this is, it can be like explained by looking at other types of like ethical theory. So for example, deontology is like a duty-based ethics. So most commonly associated with Emmanuel Kai. See,
okay,
the smile on
okay,
your face.
Right. Earlier today, you mentioned something about this all being an intervention about me being a deontologist.
Deontologist, yes.
Deontologist.
Yes.
So, you said it's duty-based?
This is actually not an episode of Ryan Reviews the Universe. This is actually a live and recorded
intervention.
Ryan, I think you might be a deontologist. That's
so,
okay. I think, for a long time, I thought I was a deontologist.
Wait, so what does it exactly mean?
Okay, so you have, obviously we talked about virtue ethics. That's trying to find of what the virtues are. So common counter arguments that is virtues to who? Like different cultures have different virtues. Where do we determine what these virtues are? Like you have to figure out where this comes from. Like where do they stem from?
Yeah.
And so deontology, most famously associated with Immanuel Kant, because he was kind of, I guess, the founding figure of this view.
Old German philosopher, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Prussian, not German.
Okay.
But yeah, German,
yeah.
You know. Let it be known that I just fact-checked the history guys. Yeah. So deontology is morality based on duties. So Immanuel Kant believed that we are autonomous people and that there is some universal aspects to the world. Like, our rationality is a universal human trait that we all have by virtue of being human. And so he believed that there is a universal moral code that as rational beings we can also access through our rationality. And one way to test this is the categorical imperative, which is going to sound a lot like the golden rule, which is act upon that which you do could be made into a universal law or maxim. So basically, like, I shouldn't do anything to you unless that sound, action can become, like...
And that does sound suspiciously like the golden rule.
Okay. Yeah. But where this gets into issues is that it's not really flexible. Like, you want to think about things like lying. Okay, yeah, I had the thought of this bit whenever you were on the shots thing on Friday.
Yeah. That's okay. Nah, that's that. Yeah. Sounds about right. I mean, it's not that I...
I can tell the meds are kicking in.
Yeah. Oh, jeez. It's not that... I don't think that I'm inherently inflexible. It's just I enjoy...
Structure.
And that just makes me sound like someone who's going to end up as a goose stepper or something like that, which isn't true at all. But
Ryan, I've often said that my ideal day, like if I had one day where I could do whatever I like, whatever to make myself happy, would definitely include a well-researched reference paper, specifically like well-researched paper, specifically the reference sheet. I love citing things. I love a good citation page. So you're not sounding too same team. Like,
okay, good, good.
We've got dorky interests.
Yeah, I mean. Yeah, that's probably that probably tracks, honestly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because I feel like structure is important, but I mean, I will see that like it is in everything. Like I'm willing to back down on that kind of stuff, I feel like.
Sure.
Yeah.
I guess, and I feel like I lean towards deontology too, because I want to believe that there are things that are, it feels like intuitive to say that there are things that are always right or wrong.
But
it's hard. It gets
I don't think. Yeah. See, I don't believe that though. Like, I don't think that there is inherent like this or that. Like, the world is never. There are binary things in this world, but in general, I won't say that the world is binary. If that makes sense.
Sure. Yeah, and that's where this gets tricky. Is that. You know, we have, again, we go back to the fact that not every culture values the same thing. So then you have different things where it's one person might think that something is totally okay. And you don't, for whatever reasons that you're born into, your society, your family, religion is a big thing, obviously. And then, there's cases like my favorite is lying. Like, when you have, like, a friend's birthday party, say. Like, you want to lie to your friend if you're throwing them a surprise birthday party. But that is wrong. And that's if you hold a deontologist view that, like, certain things, like lying, are morally reprehensible in every
I don't think I'm that adherent to deontologists.
Yeah, that's where it gets tricky. Because then you have to figure out, like, you have these rigid structures. I've seen so many people who... have tried, who are like Kant scholars, who've like come up with all these like weird little like counter arguments. We're like, well, if you have two things and the worst action outweighs this bad action, then it's okay to tell kind of like a white, I don't know, like weird ways to get around this. Because Kant was very much a rigid, like, this is your duty. Okay. You must always do your duty.
Are Kant scholars the most annoying as far as like major philosophers, or is there another group of who like adhere to like, I don't know, Plato or something like that, who are worse?
Yeah. I mean, I had a professor at IPUI who was a Kant scholar who was actually a really nice guy. Yeah. Really great. Enjoyed talking to him. But I could imagine they're probably not the most fun.
Okay.
Although I will say Immanuel Kant was known for his dinner parties.
So he's a fun guy.
Yeah.
He was a fun guy.
Well, he had rigid rules.
Oh, he had rigid rules as dinner parties.
You want to hear his rules?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Look that up real quick. Okay, so you found the dinner party stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What were some of his rules for these dinner parties?
Ryan, first of all, I would like to say, and I mean this is a compliment, I think that you and I both, well, maybe not me as a woman, but like you and I both personalities would have definitely been invited to Kant's dinner parties.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
hell yeah.
Kant was known to be a very rigid person in more ways than just his ethics. His neighbors said they could set their clocks by his daily walk. He had a very set routine. He believed in like a certain amount of hours per day on working, but he also was rigid in that he believed you should allot for pleasure, which is kind of weird and fun. So his dinner party rules, number one, the number of guests should follow Chesterfield's rule. No fewer than the Graces, no more than the Muses. So 3 to 9 people. It must not exist merely for physical satisfaction, but also for social enjoyment. And anything, this is my favorite, so anything discreet that is set at the table stays at the table. There is a moral sanctity to the dinner party and a duty of secrecy.
What happens at Kant stays at Kant?
Yes.
What happens at Kant stays at Kant?
And this, so I actually gave a presentation on my classes referencing this rule because if you follow the duty that you're not to lie, and someone asks you what was said at the party, what is more important? What is more imperative? Your duty to not gossip or your duty to not lie?
Probably your duty to not gossip. And again, it depends.
Right?
Like, not everything.
One thing is, he loved his rules. Rules for the party, rules for your ethics.
Yeah. I couldn't adhere to such a rigid schedule. Like, I do use, like, planners or whatnot, but that's because I know that, in general, I will not cease to function, but function at a way lower level if I did not have...
Well, this goes back to, I mean, both of us having ADHD and anxiety.
Yeah.
I have to have a planner because when I get all of my stuff down, you have to get it all in one spot, place, organize it. So I know, and then I can just kind of look at it. I don't follow it rigidly, but I need to have some sort of structure like that or my day is going to be all like, what the hell is I supposed to do?
Fair.
And then being really scared that I'm not doing something I'm supposed to do.
Absolutely.
There's like 9 of these rules. So I won't go through all of them, but I do think it's funny. A good party should have narration, so we should start with an exchanging of the news, and then
narration.
There's a live ratiocination, lively discussion of the diversity and judgment. So basically, when everybody's talking about different things.
Oh, so he wants arguments then?
Yeah.
Okay.
Basically, he wants you to kind of philosophize.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, like get together at Kant's house, have some wine, and no more than 9 people though, and no less than 3 because that's kind of weird. You know, just hearing a buddy. That's more like an intimate.
Yeah. 3's a crowd.
Yeah.
3's a crowd. We want to move on to one of the other, or is there any other, like, I don't know, philosophy things you want to talk about other than the fact that I may or may not be a deontologist?
The verdict is still out.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, so the other branches of ethics would be... utilitarianism, which I feel like is usually people's favorite until you start thinking about the implications behind it and how tricky it can be to kind of navigate. So utilitarianism is based on utility.
Yep.
Do what's best for the greatest number of people.
Mm-hmm.
Seems easy enough.
Until it kind of takes care for the greater good, and then that can kind of slippery slope.
Well, then you run into situations too where it's like, what I do now might be for the greater good here, but what if eventually, like 100 years from now, it leads to something really terrible and a lot of people die?
Sounds like...
Like, what if I'm planting some... Yeah,
climate
exactly.
Climate change stuff in the 90s and 80s versus how it's going to screw us over in the 2030s.
Yeah.
Yep.
How do you keep track of that? How do you keep tabs on that? So, they all have their downsides, and that's the beauty of philosophy, is that we could sit here talking all day and coming up with... The 4th one that I consider an ethical branch would be the social contract, Rousseau. So we kind of just, we are ethical people because we come together under a social contract. We all, like, are not naturally ethical people. Like, we have animal instincts. Like, out in the wild, we might kill each other for some bread. or food or whatever. But we all have agreed to kind of just like be chill and work together because that's the only way we could be a society.
Okay.
Which kind of, I mean, I don't know. I think it's fascinating to me because I don't like to believe that people are inherently bad.
Yeah, see, that was my issue as well with that. I mean, I have, in general, not the greatest view of humanity, but I don't want to believe that everyone is just inherently amoral.
Right.
Yeah. Well, so I'm not sure whether I would subscribe to that.
Let's not even get into Freud then.
Okay.
Not really philosophy necessarily, but...
Yeah, that's more psychology, right?
Yeah, he thought everybody was... He thought every person was, like, horrible and we're just, like, fueled by our id and ego and superego just kind of, like, bouncing. I'm not a Freudian, so I'm probably messing this up. But okay. He thought human nature was, like, despicable. And we needed society to keep us in line. We needed rigid, like, rules. Otherwise, we would just, like, hurt each other. And he has, like, all these, like sublimation is a big one. Like, ways that we can... subvert our bad behaviors into good ones. So like an example of this is you want to hurt people. You know that it's not okay to hurt people. You want to cut people up. So Freud says you can sublimate that by becoming a surgeon so you can cut people but not hurt them. Freud thought like that's a very, so very extreme example. But he thought that, yeah, like, we all have the, like, we all want to do evil, horrible things to some degree. And so
I'll have to get back to you on a doctor buddy of mine and see his take on that.
Be honest. Why did you really become
a doctor? Bob, if you're listening, here you go, buddy.
I want to hear a funny Freud story, though.
Yeah, sure.
So, he kind of, like, was the inventor of talk therapy. And so...
Like, letting... Not him being the person talking as the therapist,
like,
or letting...
just freely talking about what's going on.
Okay.
And just saying whatever.
Interpreting the patient or whomever
from
the conversation.
Yeah. Okay. And maybe kind of like responding with open-ended questions to keep the conversation going, but not no thoughts or of my own or feelings or judgments should be like aware in the therapy relationship. So Freud, so you probably have seen like the photos or like the image of like the therapist in the armchair and the guest.
Yeah, they're in these wonderful like couches laying, reclining back. And
You want to know why Freud started doing that?
Why?
Because he was a heavy cigar smoker and he had mouth cancer and his mouth was like all messed up. And he did not want his patients to be focused on his messed up mouth.
Really?
Yes. I'm not kidding. Huh. Also, I mean, it does work, I guess, for what he's talking about, because he wants you to kind of like, I mean, a lot of it is like dreams, trying to tap into your unconscious, your subconscious, to figure out what these desires that you want are. So when you address them, then you can sublimate them, not repress them.
Hmm.
Yeah. Freud's weird.
Yeah. I don't think I'm a Freud guy either, honestly.
No.
Well,
that's good.
Okay.
I'm sure your mom appreciates that.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Oh. Sorry, Mrs. Mason Cup.
Kelly doesn't listen
to my mom doesn't listen to my podcast. Like, nah.
So, metaphysics. You mentioned, like, you're not the biggest...
Fuck metaphysics.
Okay, yeah. Okay, yeah.
Homies hate metaphysics.
But it's like...
It's interesting.
Like, I was like, oh, are we living in a simulation kind of deal? Is that part of metaphysics, or...
I would say that is more... So the line between metaphysics and the line between epistemology is a very, very thin line. They are... twin cousins, sisters, whatever. They're like,
and correct me if I'm wrong, but epistemology is more about like analysis of knowledge, like inherent truths, that kind of deal. Okay, yeah, continue.
Epistemology, what do we know and how do we know what we know?
Okay.
And for the longest time, Plato was like, justified true belief, mic drop, and everybody was like, holy
what?
shit,
wait, what?
Just how we know something is you have a justified true belief.
Okay.
You believe something, you have justification, evidence for that belief, and it's true. I believe that this is a glass of Diet Coke. I'm justified in believing that because I poured it myself. I take a sip.
And it tastes like Diet Coke.
Still Diet Coke.
Okay.
That's a true belief.
Gotcha.
So then this guy Gettier comes along in like the 1900s, publishes one like two-page paper, which is unheard of in the philosophical world.
Because it's so short, I assume?
Yeah. Okay. So quick, gives you two examples of what are called Gettier cases, where you have a justified true belief that doesn't feel like knowledge.
Okay.
So
I'm not sure whether I follow.
Okay. Let me explain. So this is a rough paraphrase of one of his examples. So let's say you've got Smith and Jones, and they're both interviewing for the same job. Smith doesn't feel like his interview went very well. And so he hears somebody talking about how, like, somebody in the office, he over like hears a conversation where they're talking about how Jones is going to get the job. Hold on, I'm butchering this. I'm gonna look up one really quick so I can just double. Actually, no, I got this. Hold on. You're gonna cut this part out.
I've never had to do that before.
Oh, no, you can keep it in. It's fine. Okay, I'm trying to remember exactly. So it's a justified true belief that doesn't feel like knowledge. So Jones and Smith are both interviewing for a job. Mm-hmm. Jones definitely has 9 cents in his pocket. And then the person who gets the job has like change of 9 cents in their pocket. So Smith knows this about Jones and thinks that Jones is going to get the job. So he has the belief that person who will get the job has 9 coins in their pocket. Jones, whatever. Turns out he had 9 cents in his pocket too. Something like that. That weird, like following that premise, like something he was believing, but he gets the job. Does that make sense?
No, it really doesn't.
Okay, hold on. Pause this really quick. I'm going to look. I feel like I'm I'm so trying to like explain this.
So does Smith just not check his pockets the entire time?
Hold on. I'm going to look up the one that he, because I'm butchering it somehow. It's been a couple semesters in Milan.
Also, all these philosophy scenarios are just inherently hilarious. This is like, oh, guys with money in their pockets, whoever has exactly
that's what I'm saying. That's why I keep. Okay, so I was right. Okay, so. Oh my gosh.
Pull the lever, kill one person. Don't pull the lever, kill 10.
Yeah. So Smith attends a job interview and hears that Jones will get the job.
Okay.
He later sees Jones counting 10 coins in his pocket, determines that the person who gets the job will have 10 coins in their pocket. Lo and behold, Smith actually gets the job, and he also did not realize he had 10 coins in his pocket. I hate analytic philosophy. Analytic philosophy is, yeah, just kind of like taking these very like absurd cases, which they're necessary. They're necessary. Logic is necessary, and it's fun, but it hurts my brain.
Yeah. I feel like logic hurting my brain should be reserved for like Sudoku or something like that, not like these super constrained bullshit. Not that this is bullshit.
No, yeah, it's, I mean, there's like another barn case where you like see a red barn.
Okay.
And you think that it's a barn because it looks like a barn. So you have the belief that is a justified belief that it's a barn. But then it turns out that it's a prop barn. You don't realize you're driving past a movie studio and it's just a cardboard thing. Like a lot of weird stuff where like...
Oh, I get that one then.
Yeah, just like, I don't know. That's,
seeing
yeah.
isn't everything and just like...
Right.
Just because like it's a fallacy to believe like, oh, X has happened the past 9 times.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean like, oh, if I flip a coin 5 times and it's landed on heads the past 5 times, this doesn't mean that I won't land on tails the 6th time.
Yeah, because when you get into the like nitty gritty of like epistemology, like the big camps from what I remember are like reliabilism, which is basically saying things like you rely on reliable things. Like your system's working, your eyes are working, everything's working. You feel like this is what a Diet Coke glass always looks like. This is what a hat looks like.
Yeah.
I can trust these senses that they're working the way they're supposed to. But then you run into things like that where it's like, well, your perception can sometimes be messed up. Mm. Sometimes you, what you see is not actually there. And you're justified in thinking that it's a barn. He didn't realize that was old fake barn Fred's house where he's got a bunch of cardboard things of barns hanging up outside.
Fred's got some problems, yeah.
Oh, and then there's like evidentialism. There's this guy whose name I can't, a philosopher, who's really big in this. His name I can't remember off the top of my head. I'm not going to look it up. But he's an evidentialist, and I watched this talk when I was in my epistemology class where he kept saying the evidence is the evidence. And I was just like, I feel like my like little ducks like flying around in my head, or the birds like when you get hit in the head on a cartoon show. I'm just like,
yeah,
what
yeah.
the fuck? But yeah, so epistemology, metaphysics, to kind of like take it back, are very closely related, and you can't really talk about one without kind of like entering the other. Metaphysics is like, well, how do we know what this is? Like, mm-hmm. where does the table start and the chair start? What are the parts of a chair? What are the boundaries of a chair? Like, what makes...
You can feel them, right? Like, I know this is a chair because... Like I am.
But what are you feeling?
I'm feeling the wood on the chair.
Sure. So a chair is wood?
A chair doesn't have to be wood, but this chair is wood.
Okay.
Partially wood, at least.
How do you know that it's a chair and not just a piece of wood shaped like a chair?
I mean, because I can sit in it and it's relatively comfortable. And if it's a piece of wood that's shaped like a chair and it looks like a
I'm relatively comfortable.
Yeah, but... Okay.
Is this a chair?
Okay. Chelsea is now sitting on the table. But the table doesn't look like a chair, though.
But what does a chair look like?
See, now we're getting to, like...
There's a lot, a lot of different chairs.
Yeah, there, yeah. There are a lot of different chairs.
Some have backs, some don't. Is that a stool or a chair? Is it a stool a chair?
Is a stool a chair? This sounds like one of those, like... Is a taco a sandwich?
Yes, this is exactly what people spend their entire academic careers arguing with each other like this.
So this chair exercise is really just like a philosopher's version of like, is a burrito a cannoli kind of deal or mm-hmm. whatever.
Yeah. It's kind of like, I mean, and this is what the thing about philosophy and why you need to understand all of them. And even though, like, I talk, you know, shit, I'm like, fuck it, alert philosophy. There's a place for everything, and they all are so intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, like, we think about stuff, like, one of my favorite thought experiments in metaphysics is, like, when you think about, like, statues. Like,
okay.
Like, when does it become the Statue of David? And then, like, there's, like, this really specific example of, like, when does it not become the Statue of David? What if you were able to, like, take it and hollow it out and no one knows it's hollowed out? It still has the form of it. Is it still the statue? Is it still the same? Like, does it change?
I mean, it changes. So it looks exactly like the Statue of David, but it's only, like, an inch thick or something like that. Mm-hmm. Is it still?
Somehow defying the laws of physics, we have hollowed out the Statue of David. It's still
yes.
wherever it
is. I would argue yes.
It still is. Yeah. I mean, and it's, there's no wrong answers necessarily. It's like personal, and I feel like intuition plays a big role, you know? Like what you mm-hmm. like. That's why these thought experiments are so fun, because I could sit here all day and tell you like there are people in metaphysics, there are analytic philosophers right now who say there are no chairs. There's no such thing as a chair. This is a group of myriological symbols. Some may say atoms. You might say quarks. You might say subatomic particles.
Gluons, something. Whatever, yeah.
It just looks like a chair because I've decided that it's a chair, but it's not a chair. There is no chair.
Well, I mean,
there
we have a society have like decided like, oh, this looks like a chair, therefore it must be a chair. But like...
Mm-hmm. It's a concept.
I don't know. Yeah, it is
all the way down.
Yeah.
But then... You know, we're like, okay, where do these concepts come from?
Does that what have is something it? To do with like Platonic ideals or whatever?
Yeah, that's okay. One answer to the solution. Okay. That like this is a chair by virtue of the fact that
it's somewhat there's close.
An ideal chair somewhere floating in heaven.
Man, I would like to sit in said chair.
Can you imagine how comfortable that chair would be?
That chair would be pretty... Actually, see, I feel like most chairs aren't inherently that... super comfortable. So yeah, I feel like
we as a society have strayed away from Platonism. Like we need to go back to
Platonic ideals. So I feel like the Platonic ideal of a chair actually wouldn't be super comfortable. It would just be the most chair-like chair.
Yeah.
That ever chaired.
And more chaired than you've ever even known.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. All we've seen are shadows of chairs. And all we've
yeah, exactly. The Platonic ideal of a chair.
Well, I think talking about Plato was probably a good segue into drinking. Plato loved having drinking parties.
Oh, there you go. It's like,
Plato and his buddies loved drinking stinky wine with cheese and like grains in it and like hallucinating. And then just a couple guys, some of them lovers, some of them not, sitting around saying, "What is a society? What is a just society?"
Sounds like some people I used to know in college.
drinking.
Yep.
Drinking and talking with butts.
What is a society? Yeah.
We live in a society.
We do live in a society. What would be your platonic ideal of a cocktail be? Like as far as cocktail builds.
Because
Chelsea's also a bartender. She works at the same spot I did. Along with Fernando and Alex has taught me a lot about how to not screw up behind the bar.
You're doing great.
Good.
Oh, only mildly in the way. Not as often. No, you're doing a great job, Ryan. Passing on the torch.
Yeah. Thank you. Platonic ideal of a cocktail. What would you say is the closest to that?
It's an interesting thing to think about, too. I mean, because that's, you know, I mean, I would not call myself, like, a Plato scholar by any means, although I feel fairly familiar. But then you get into the aspect of, like, so...
Well, to you personally.
Yeah. Right? Okay, my ideal cocktail.
Yeah, your ideal. Maybe not Plato's ideal cocktail.
I don't want to toot my own horn, necessarily, but I am a really big fan of the Doctrine of Flux.
Okay, Doctrine of Flux is a it's a daiquiri build we have over at Bluebeard. It has a little bit of Amaro in it, has some passion fruit, a very overproof rum with the most like jank label of all time.
Mm-hmm. And also it's near and dear to my heart because it's a sneaky philosophy reference that nobody ever understands. And when I tell them, they're just like, okay, that's cool. Thanks for wasting five minutes.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So,
well, did I
tell you what the reference is?
No.
So, it's very quick. So, there's a pre-Socratic philosopher, Heraclitus, who believed, like, so basically the pre-Socratic philosophers...
So, very, very old then, if he's pre-Socratic. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Like, 500 BCE?
Okay.
400 to 600 BCE, somewhere around that
I'll
area.
I'll put out a retraction next episode if you're wrong.
You'll have to fact check me on that one. But... so basically the pre-Socratics were just like, pre-Socratics were just sitting around like, the fuck is that? What am I? Trying to figure it out, right? Like we all still are.
Yeah.
Still having the same conversations. And he just thought that like, everything was constantly changing. You probably have heard, he wrote in like aphorisms. You probably heard, you don't ever step into the same river twice. You can only step in the same river once.
Okay, yeah. Because the rivers, if the water's not the same water that was previously, also maybe some sediment or rock has moved. And
sure,
yeah. Okay,
it's flowing differently. Things.
And rivers,
over here. Yep. There's rain happened. You know, it's been hot. Some of it evaporated. What have you, the cycle. So a lot of it's like you have like Thales and Miletus who was like everything is water, and then you have other. So a lot of the pre-Socratics kind of get like lumped into like this guy thought everything was matter, and so like Heraclitus is often like thought of as the fire guy, because he used fire.
the fire guy.
He used fire as like a metaphor because fire is like the perfect example of
ever moving, ever changing.
Yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
Rum fire.
Oh.
Doctrine of flux. There he said everything is in flux.
Gotcha.
See?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so about, it's about the look that Vargas gave you.
Play on Rum Fire, which is that aforementioned jank labeled.
Mm-hmm. Overproof Jamaican rum.
It's really good.
Yeah. Rum colonializers were like, here you go.
Yep.
Drink this. Here's your falernum since you don't have food.
Mm-hmm. Which is very problematic, but hey, we got a cool liquor out of it, so.
Yeah. And I think things are better now.
Mm-hmm.
Not great, but better. Not great, bestie. I'm going to do my PhD on rum colonialism.
Might be an interesting PhD. I'd read that book. Yeah. We're going to do a kind of, how do I want to call this? We're going to do a list. We're going to do a ranking, as we normally do. Favorite ingredients to use in cocktails. Guests go first. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, you know me. I'm a rum fan.
Okay.
I love rum.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like my favorite thing about rum is that most spirits don't want to be mixed with other things of their kind. Like, think about whiskey. How often do you see people, I mean, every now and then it's done, but like people don't blend bourbons together, like different bourbons in a cocktail all the time. Like, you don't see like a...
Like, there are blended bourbons, but people don't blend.
They don't say like, this cocktail needs a Tennessee whiskey, a Canadian whiskey, and scotch. Yeah. That's what we needed. But like rum, like every region is different. It's an expression of the climate, which are also vastly different. It's an expression of the culture. Like funky Jamaican rum is a big thing. Like Ray and Nephew with like a ting in Jamaican like bars is just like a staple. Like that's just like their highball.
Mm-hmm.
And Ray and Nephew is like another overproof rum. Like Rum Fire, Ray and Nephew. I can't remember the other big one. Hampton Estates, I think. Anyways, but like those overproof rums, like they're funky. It's an expression of that area, that culture, the flavors that are there. And that's a lot, like rum lends, not only lends itself, but also works best, I would argue, in some cases, blended with other rums. Like the Rum Old Fashioned that I did, like I love just like mixing together different like rums for that. Like it started with two like different Jamaican rums. It was Appleton 12, and
Smith and Cross, I believe.
Yeah. And then just like playing around with other stuff that we've had. And like that new like Planteray one that kind of tastes like Samoas. Like I put that in a dessert drink last night with the Creole Rum Agricole and Ray and Nephew. Smith and Cross.
Okay.
Funky Jamaican rum. Coconut sweet like rum, which is sweetened naturally. Like no added sweetener to it that I know of. And a Creole spiced rum agricole, which rum agricole is made with like sugar canes. So it's like grassy. And they all just like chef's kiss. Like I was like, this is going to be weird. They just, you know, they blend together. So I like working with rum. I actually was talking to a friend of the pod, Brian Sanders.
Yep. Brian Sanders. Yeah, we'll probably have him on for a movie episode at some point in the future.
He definitely should. He would be a great person to talk about movies on here. I told Brian, I was like, you know what I realized? You make cocktails that you don't want to drink that are good, but other, like, you make a cocktail for other people. Like, think about, like, the Flower Girl. Like, that's not a Brian drink, but it's good. And he made it specifically because he knew people would like it.
I feel like that's also one of our other bartenders, Hugo, as well.
Yeah.
He doesn't exactly like tequila that much. He's just a straight gin tonic guy. But he makes a lot of tequila cocktails.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like me, like, not always. If Lonely Hearts Club was me trying to, like, make a cocktail that was approachable for other people. That's not really a me drink.
Mm-hmm. A little bit too sweet for you in general?
For the most part, I like to take the challenge of, like, trying to make things that are not generally approachable. Like...
Malort.
Yeah. Approachable.
Yeah,
I like the Lonely Hearts Club. It's not too sweet necessarily, but it's just not not my bag.
No.
I mean, it's good. You know.
At my number one, I think I'll take lemon juice.
Is that your favorite citrus?
It's definitely, no, it's not my favorite citrus, but it's definitely the most utilitarian of the citruses. I feel like you can...
I
like lime juice better, but I think that you can use lemon juice more because it's maybe, calling it neutral just isn't true at all because it's just so bloody acidic, but it's more neutral than...
Well, lemon's more acidic than lime, right?
Wait, really?
That's what I thought.
Huh, okay.
Fact check me on that, but I'm pretty sure
Yeah. Brian told me. Not the PH or whatever. Yeah, this is another question for Brian Sanders.
Brian!
Where you at, buddy? Yeah. I'll take lemon juice at my second slot. What are you taking?
I'll do lime. I feel like lime pairs with rum overall.
So you're just building a rum cocktail now.
Yeah. Although I do feel like I tend to gravitate towards lime more than lemon. I don't know.
I'll take tequila.
Okay.
I don't know. I don't like Blancos nearly as much as I like Reposados. And just inherently, you're typically going to use Blancos more in cocktail building. We do have a couple like baseline Reposados mm-hmm. that work that we can work with. But
I've been liking that DeVito Reposado Mezcal for a Mezcal Negroni or Mezcal Old Fashioned.
Mm-hmm. I just love that Grand Centenario Reposado for... Mm-hmm. Stuff I want to say that we used that in, was it Hugo's drink or mm-hmm.
Forever Fall, and so also in the Paloma.
Mm-hmm. But love tequila. I generally don't like it neat. I just always liking my cocktails. So yeah,
there you go. Tequila is always my go-to shot. I don't know why. I don't mind it.
Over Malort is your go-to shot?
Well, if you had Malort, I would do it. But tequila is a little bit more accessible.
Mm-hmm.
You know what my least favorite cocktail is, though?
What, like of the classics or the stuff at work?
Just like general. Margaritas. I love daiquiris. I hate margaritas.
Really? Is the like too sweet with the orange liqueur or whatnot?
I don't know. It's just something about them. I don't know. I just don't like them.
Mm-hmm.
I like daiquiris, but like... I like a souped up daiquiri. Like, that's why I like my Dr.
Because there really isn't that much difference between a daiquiri and a marg. Well, except tequila versus rum and then orange liqueur versus no orange liqueur. Like, those are the
two main pretty differences. Similar. And you don't always have to use triple sec, I guess, in a margarita. You could just kind of do it like that. But yeah, that, like, riff on a sour build. You got your tart, your simple. And I'm not, I don't gravitate towards like tart forward cocktails, like acidic mm-hmm. forward cocktails.
Yeah. What are you taking? Oh, you already took lime. Mm-hmm. No, I took tequila. Okay, so you're next.
Okay. I should probably pick a syrup, huh? Orgeat.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I was going to go along the same lines. Orgeat, for those who don't know, is essentially a almond simple. Typically like almonds are like roasted beforehand and then mm-hmm. strained and then a lot of sugar is added, all that stuff. It kind of adds body to a cocktail, mm-hmm. Which sometimes can be hard. A lot of like thicker syrups can also do the same thing, mm-hmm. which is kind of why I was worried that you were going to take it's not simple. I was going to take honey. Is my
you can have honey. You can have old bother. Yeah, I think I like orgeat because that was why I put orgeat in the Malort cocktail that I made, and then I put orgeat in when I did like a rum espresso martini because I feel like it's like a blanket for those like harsh spirits. It gives it like it's like I'm subduing all the disgusting aspects of you with a beautiful almond flavor.
Yeah.
Let's make an orgeat. You get to snack on the little almond bits.
That's true. Yeah, it's just like, there's nothing better than eating pretty much straight marzipan. It's pretty good, not gonna lie.
That's a healthy potback breakfast. Followed up with your lunch olives and Luxardo cherries.
Exactly.
And for dinner, a piece of Francese bread and a shot.
I was like, let's figure out what's on the charcuterie board while we're at it.
Yeah, Ryan! Charcuterie board!
Oh, jeez.
That'll be my favorite pre-ship.
What you got?
All right. I want rye.
Okay, cool. Can I take Amaros in general, or would I have to pick a specific one? Or a specific type of Amaro. Like, would I have to differentiate between, like...
What if we say you can take all true Italian Amaros?
Yeah, I'll do that over Alpine Amaros, for sure. Or, like, Fernets.
Okay, because then I'm coming for Cina, bitch. French Amaro.
Yeah. Well, okay. So, Amaro, literally Italian for bitter.
Uh-huh.
Technically, like, Malort is an Amaro. But When Chelsea says like classic Italian Amaros, that generally means like your Camparis, your Aperol, a select Cappelletti, anything that is red and tastes like orange peel and is a little bit bitter. But generally,
falls into aperitivo and digestive, right? So then you're thinking like the Fernets on the digestive side and bitter.
It doesn't have to be an Amaro to be aperitif or digestif, though. Because I feel like there are some liqueurs that aren't Amaros that can be digestifs, though, right?
Hold on, like what?
Port is an Amaro, but that's a digestif.
Is it? Well, yeah, that would be... Yeah, because it's wine-based.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so is... Cappelletti is considered one too. That's wine-based.
But that's but that's also different. This is what I'm saying. So like, there's no strict definition of what an Amaro is.
Yeah.
It's just like.
It means bitter in Italian. It
means bitter in Italian.
Yeah.
And you know it when you see it.
Yeah. The brighter red it is, the more bitter it is. If you're talking about Campari and Select, I feel like.
I'll take Italian Amaros then.
All right, you can have those. I'm gonna take Chianti and then I want French Amaros.
What other Italian Amaros, I mean French Amaros are there?
I don't know. I want Chianti.
That's fair.
My bar's all booze. I want rum, rye, and Chianti. What else could you need?
I will take... Okay. I will take... Oh, so you took rye. I took Italian Amaros. You took Chianti. So for my last pick... Jeez. See, I don't like whiskey or bourbon that much to...
What about
like,
favorite non-traditional citrus and or juice to use in cocktailing?
I don't like orange juice enough to pick that as my last pick. I almost want to take gin.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'll take gin.
What's your favorite spirit?
Hmm?
What is your favorite spirit? Is it Amaro?
It's probably... I was going to take rum, but if we're including Amaros in there, then it will probably just be Amaros.
Yeah, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay. Or no wine on the bar, though, because this is just...
No. I mean, sure, yeah, we'll use it. Like, when's the last time someone ordered? Is it a New York Sour that uses wine?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When's
the last time someone ordered that from you?
Like, within the last month.
Oh, really?
Yeah. There you go. It doesn't happen that often. Or, like, a good spritz.
Yeah.
I like a good spritz.
Yeah. People do be ordering Aperol spritzes. This is true. All right.
More of a
Any other time. Last things you want to say before we wrap this all up?
No, I mean, any closing thoughts on philosophy you want to share from your searches? Are you worried you might be a deontologist now?
I don't think I really am a deontologist. I think that I can be rigid in my ways, but I think that's just because I'm just a stubborn fellow. I don't believe it sounds like, am I pronouncing it right? Deontology. Like they believe that everything is black or white, right or wrong kind of deal. And I,
yeah, like, well, that you have a duty and that you can find, like, there's a duty and not only more so than just having the duty, because you could have self-imposed duties, there is a universal duty of moralities. Count how many times I said duty in that sentence.
Duty.
You have a universal moral responsibility that you can access and you should follow and live by. So it is black and white.
Maybe. I don't know. Perhaps. Chelsea, thank you so much for coming onto the pod.
Thanks for having really me, Ryan. Enjoyed. This is fun.
Yeah, I really did enjoy this.
I'll send you my syllabus when I teach an intro class.
Crap, I didn't want there to be homework.